From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Hundreds of thousands of federal employees remain off the job or are returning to work after the Christmas holiday without pay as the government shutdown enters day five. There remains no sign of a deal between Congress and President Trump, who spoke to reporters yesterday at the White House.
It's going to all work out. But many of those workers have said to me and communicated, stay out until you get the funding for the wall. These federal workers want the wall. The only one that doesn't want the wall are the Democrats.
For more, we're joined by NPR's congressional correspondent Susan Davis in Washington. Hi, Sue.
Hey, Jeremy.
So the Senate comes back tomorrow. The House has announced no votes before tomorrow, so there won't be a vote today, even if a deal is struck. But are talks even happening right now? Who's negotiating?
That's a very good question. I think the last public face that we've had on these negotiations was really negotiations taking a turn for the worst. The Democratic leaders, Nancy Pelosi in the House and Chuck Schumer in the Senate, put out a joint statement on Christmas Eve that was a pretty stinging rebuke of the president, saying that his Twitter rants about any number of topics, his unwillingness to say exactly what he will or won't sign, was making negotiations really difficult. So there has been no discernible process or progress made on the shutdown. I will say that I do think a lot of people took a break for the Christmas holiday, and I think those conversations are reinvigorating today, but mainly on a staff level. And we'll see when all the principals are back in town tomorrow.
Do the Democrats have any incentive to make a deal with the president when they are about to take over the majority in the House in just a matter of days?
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of the things I've said about this is this really isn't a policy argument we're having. We're having a political fight, and it's unclear who's going to blink first. And I would say Democrats that I've talked to don't really feel any real pressure to be the one that caves in this situation and give in to the president to give him a victory on the wall. They look at a midterm election that just happened in which they picked up 40 seats in the House in which they're about to take a majority. And the voters that put them into power, mainly women, minorities, people of color, young people, are all groups of people who overwhelmingly oppose the wall. Mm-hmm. So for Democrats, they're looking at this and saying, we've just been rewarded with voters with the majority. Why should our first act be to cut a deal that does something these voters directly oppose?
What has been the impact so far of the shutdown, both on parts of the government that are shut down and on the people who are supposed to provide services and maybe aren't getting paid?
Yeah, I think that it's really going to start to be felt by workers today. Christmas Eve and Christmas were federal holidays, so a lot of people were naturally not working. This affects hundreds of thousands of federal workers who are not working and not collecting pay. It also affects hundreds of thousands of government workers who are working, who have been deemed essential to the functions of government and are just having to work without pay. I will say, because we've had several shutdowns in recent years, we kind of know how this goes. When the government reopens, the government does tend to award these workers back pay. So they may have to go without pay for a time. It should not be forever. It really does depend on the length of the shutdown, how much of a crunch these workers feel in their personal lives. I'd say broadly, most Americans don't feel the effects of a shutdown. Much of the government has been funded, things like the Defense Department and other things. And also, you know, most of the functions of government that are deemed essential. You know, the TSA agents are still at the airports, for example. And I think one of the reasons that most Americans don't feel it has kind of changed the calculation among politicians who seem to be more willing to have these shutdown fights because I don't think there is a direct anger related from voters. It's not felt right away. You know, if they reopen the government this week, I'm not sure that this is the thing that's going to keep voters sustained throughout the year.
Just briefly,
tend to move on.
The government was shut down on Monday, but Wall Street was open and the markets tanked. How worried is the White House about the market situation?
I think you can tell that there's worry because of comments the president has made, specifically attacking the Federal Reserve and suggesting they do not understand the economy. This goes to the core of who President Trump is and who he promised to be. He was going to revive the economy, bring about jobs. And I think anything that undermines that weakens him. And I think he recognizes that. And that's part of the reason why I think the White House has been so forceful in trying to place the blame elsewhere on this. And I think they're dealing with the fact that, you know, the long-term projections for the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, the tax cut that was passed under President Trump, there's Wall Street Journal and other analysis out this week that's saying maybe the effects are going to be a little bit more modest than they promised. And that's a reality he's going to have to confront as well.
Finally, Sue, the U.S. Customs and Border Protection has ordered medical checks on all children in its custody after the death on Christmas Eve of an 8-year-old boy from Guatemala in the agency's care. This is the second death of an immigrant child in the agency's custody this month. What's the government saying about why this is happening?
Well, it's certainly affecting in its own way the debate over the shutdown. I think this has further emboldened a lot of Democrats to say that they do not want to negotiate with an administration that they believe has been unsupportive of their border policies. The U.S. Border Patrol did announce in response to this that they're going to be conducting secondary medical checks upon all children in their custody and that they're reviewing their policies on how they focus on the care and custody of children, particularly under the age of 10 and when they are taken into custody within the first 24 hours.
Susan Davis, NPR congressional correspondent. Sue, thanks.
You're welcome.
Russia says Israeli missile strikes late last night in Syria put two civilian flights in danger. Syrian state media said the missiles hit an arms depot near the capital, Damascus. There's been no official comment from the Israeli government, but Israel has long been concerned about Iran's activity in Syria. And with news that the U.S. is withdrawing troops from the country, there are new questions about who will step in to fill the power vacuum in the region. Jim Walsh is here now, security analyst. He's with MIT. Security Studies Program. Jim, it's always good to see you.
Merry Christmas. A belated Merry Christmas.
And
Peter,
to you. Thanks for coming in a day after the holiday. Your thoughts. How concerned is Israel that by pulling U.S. troops out of Syria, a check on Iran will be lost?
Well, sure. I mean, I can see why they'd prefer it rather than not have it, because we had some mission creep in the U.S. deployment to Syria. Originally, it was only to fight ISIS, you may remember. And then it started to be, well, we're going to fight ISIS and we're going to stay here until the Iranians leave Syria. Of course, we weren't invited into Syria. We just forced our way in. The Iranians were invited into Syria, but we were going to stay until the Iranians left. And then a third objective was added to the Syrian mission, which was to stay and make sure that Assad left. So we had a lot of mission creep. Hmm. But listen, long before we deployed 500 that turned into 2,000 troops, Iran and Syria have had an alliance since the Iran-Iraq War of the early 1980s. So they've been allied a long time. It's in both countries' self-interest. I mean, I don't like the alliance. I think Assad's a war criminal. But if you're sitting in Damascus or Tehran, you see an ally, and that alliance is not going anywhere, whether we have 2,000 troops in Syria or not.
Do you see any change to Russia's approach, to Israel's approach, now that the U.S. appears to be leaving?
Well, I think there will be. I think the biggest impact, obviously, will be on the Kurds, bar none. They are the ones who are sort of left holding the bag here, and they have to decide, can they cut a deal with Assad and retain some autonomy, or are they looking at a war with Turkey? So I think the biggest consequences for them in the magnitude and in the near term. Obviously, there are questions about regional stability, but, you know, we seem to have forgotten that, and I don't like this, but, you know, facts are facts. Assad won the war, right? I mean, you know, it's not all done. ISIS isn't all gone. There are parts. But Assad and Russia and Iran won that war. And my guess is they're going to quite happily kill as many ISIS fighters as they can find.
On Friday, after the president said he would pull all U.S. forces out of Syria and also cut half the number of troops from Afghanistan, I spoke to former Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, and here's what he told me.
I'm one who thinks that we need a good examination of what we're doing there and why we're there, but not the way President Trump has done it. The way he's done it is very dangerous.
So on Afghanistan, here you say you see a former defense secretary saying he's open to the idea of taking troops out. Maybe we should be having that debate. That's just the way that it was done is damaging. When you look back at 2018, where do you think this decision on Afghanistan will stand?
Well, it's clear the president wants to draw down. I personally think he has the right instincts, and I wish, you know, more secretaries of defense would come to that conclusion while they were still in office rather than when they retired, although I'm a big fan of Chuck Hagel's. But that be said, we've been at war in Afghanistan for 17 years. How long are we going to stay? Are we going to stay forever?
Right. And what it's expensive. I mean, that's the other point people
are making. What's the definition
of
a win here?
Right.
I really feel like we're trying to avoid a loss, and that's not a good rationale for staying in. But I agree also with the former Secretary of Defense. You know, it's not only what you do, it's how you do it. And if you do it in a really – if you sort of screw it up, the implementation part of it, then it can turn out to be a very costly exercise. In this case, you shouldn't just be blurting things out on Twitter, obviously. You would want to consult with your allies. You'd want to turn internally and have the different parts of the government come up with an exit plan. You know, you'd want to minimize your exposures and help your friends if you can as you go through this difficult process. But and so we'll see how it goes. But you asked about the coming year. I expect those numbers to go down rather than go up.
All right. Jim Mattis will be done January 1st. Patrick Shanahan will be the acting defense secretary at that point. He's had a long career at Boeing, very little military or government experience. Is he up to the job of taking these troops out of Syria, out of Afghanistan? It is a huge undertaking.
You know, number one, I don't know. But the job of Secretary of Defense, it's a lot of things. But one of it is managing a big bureaucracy. And certainly Boeing was a big bureaucracy. And we've had political appointees. You know, Chuck Hagel was a senator. We have had senators who have run cabinets and despite direct experience have been successful. It'll depend on his relationship with the president, and it'll depend on his relationship inside the building at the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. But I don't know of any reason off the top of my head why he shouldn't be able to do the job if he's been sitting in the chair of the number two for 2 years.
Okay, very quickly, what will the top story of 29 be from your 2019 be from your perspective? I know you've got a couple seconds. Just give me a slug.
Oh, yeah, okay. North Koreans resume nuclear testing. How about that for an out-of-the-box possibility?
That'll do it. Jim Walsh here, Now Security Analyst. Thank you. Starting next week, China will slash tariffs on imports of American-made cars and some auto parts. It's a concession in trade talks between Beijing and Washington. It also comes as demand in China slows, and Chinese automakers are making a big push to sell their cars in the United States. Willie Shi is professor of management practice at Harvard Business School. And Professor Shi, I know you've been to a number of Chinese auto factories. What is the state of the auto market there?
Well, there are aspects of the market there which, if you study history, would look like the 1910s and 1920s in the U.S. Hundreds of companies. I went to the Shanghai Auto Show a couple years ago, and I think there were close to 300 vendors there. So it's kind of classic early market in China where a lot of competition. And I think we're at a phase now where there are certain players who are starting to emerge as certainly strong domestic players, and some, particularly companies like Geely and BYD, have global ambitions. Mm.
And when you're in those factories, what do you see? What strikes you?
Well, they look like typical factories that you would see in the U.S. or in Europe or Japan or Korea. They are equipped with robots. One thing that struck me a couple of years ago when I went through one of these lesser domestic brand factories in the city of Wuhan, which is in central China, was I looked at the factory and it's like, wow, this is, you know, your typical car factory that's sized to make 230,000 vehicles a year or so. How come you're only making 30?
Really?
Yeah.
And what was the answer to that?
Well, they were having trouble selling them, okay, because there's so much competition. So there's a lot of excess capacity in China. And a lot of the excess capacity has been driven by regional governments who just say, we need to have a car factory in our locale.
So you've got some of these companies that are now taking a look at the United States as a market. They want to get in.
Sure. The U.S. is the richest market in the world. You know, if you look at Chinese manufacturers, they've succeeded in all manner of goods export to the U.S., right? And so just like the Japanese before them and the Koreans after the Japanese, you know, I think a lot of Chinese companies would say, you know, if we're going to become a global player, we have to be in the U.S. market as well.
I wonder if American consumers would want Chinese cars or look at them and see something desirable.
Already, I think we will see some things that will appeal to American consumers because they're innovative and they're kind of clever. I took a class to Shenzhen, and we went to the BYD factory. They're cranking the vehicles out. We go over to the showroom, and one of the problems in China is sometimes the parking spaces are kind of narrow, right? So when you buy a BYD car, there's some models that come with a remote control. Okay, so what you do is You get out of the car, okay, and then you get a little remote, which is this smaller than a TV remote. And, you know, you can start the car and you can steer it, right? So you can back it into the parking space and have no clearance on the side. I think there are American consumers who would look at that and say, that's pretty innovative. Maybe I'd like to try that.
There's another thing I want to ask you about. The Chinese government is making this huge push for electric vehicles. In fact, they've announced recently that if you're a new company, you're not even going to be able to make fossil fuel vehicles.
Right.
How significant is that?
I think it's highly significant because if you look at internal combustion engines and you look at people who really do these well, the Germans, you know, the big three in Detroit, the Japanese, you know, they have generations of experience doing that. But the Chinese say, well, if I can ride this technology transition, I'm already the number one producer of batteries.
They'll be on the front wave of this new technology.
Well, it's like I don't need any of that infrastructure that all you guys are burdened with. We have a historic opportunity to just turn the competition upside down.
Mm-hmm. Finally, the trade war between the United States and China. Does that affect what's happening in the Chinese automotive industry and especially its vision for its American market?
We live in a world now that is very complicated because the supply chains have been laid out over a relatively benign period where we encouraged companies to locate in many different geographies and source parts from many different places, and it was efficient and it brought consumers low cost. And now what happens is you change the rules. I see a world going to companies saying, I have to serve the China market and I have to serve the U.S. market. Historically, I think the view was I serve the markets from the most efficient sites. I'll use combinations of components sourced from lots of different areas. I think that's changing. Hmm. And there will be some big surprises in that.
That's Willie Shi, who's been looking at the Chinese auto market, a professor of management practice at the Harvard Business School. Willie, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
A recent survey by GLSEN, a nonprofit group that supports LGBTQ students, asked those students whether their schools offered sex education that was inclusive of their experiences and identities. Less than 10% said yes, and nearly a quarter reported receiving no sex ed at all. That may be because only half of all states actually require schools to teach sex ed. In Illinois, it may also be because of a state law. Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines explains.
Sex education in Illinois is optional. Districts do not have to teach sex ed if they don't want to. But if they do teach it, there's some basic rules in state law they need to follow. Among them is that all sex ed course material must, quote, teach honor and respect for monogamous heterosexual marriage.
Wow, I hate that.
That's Toby. He's a 17-year-old high school senior from Chicago. He identifies as gay and asked us not to use his last name for this story.
That's really screwed up. We gotta change that. That's... ugh. Why? Am I not normal or something? Because that's what they're... I feel like that's what they're trying to get at here. Like, I'm not normal, so I don't deserve the right sex ed.
Elizabeth Nash says focusing on monogamous heterosexual marriage in the law sends the message that teaching sex ed that's reflective of LGBTQ experiences isn't important.
You are sending a big red signal, a big flashing sign, that discussion around LGBTQIA issues are not on the agenda.
Nash is with the Guttmacher Institute. They're a research and policy organization that advocates for reproductive health and rights. Nash says that line about heterosexual marriage in Illinois' sex ed law dates back to 1989.
There was no such thing as marriage equality. So when you said marriage, you meant heterosexual marriage. So you really were essentially closing off the sex education to LGBTQIA individuals.
The Illinois State Board of Education said in an email that school districts are allowed to interpret this line in the law however they want. As an example, Chicago Public Schools has an inclusive sex ed policy, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's consistently implemented in every classroom. Lily Ferguson is a 17-year-old senior at a Chicago public high school. She talked to me with a group of students. Ferguson says she got a great sex education in middle school, but that changed her freshman year.
My high school, I felt like, had the opportunity to teach that, and they just didn't. They were like, this is what giving birth looks like when you're a teen. And it's just very, like, fear-mongering, and also the only point is to say, this is how heterosexual sex happens, yeah. And don't have heterosexual sex, or else you will get pregnant and die.
Dan Rice says a lot of educators are dissatisfied with the status quo, too. He's the director for Training with Answer, a national organization based at Rutgers University that promotes and provides comprehensive sex ed training.
I hear from a lot of educators that they know that there are LGBTQ youth in their schools, and they find that talking about this topic is super important, but they also fear that they don't have the support of the administration or there's no policy in place that allows them to talk about this information, and so they feel hesitant.
A 2016 Centers for Disease Control report shows lesbians and bisexual youth are more likely to become pregnant than their heterosexual peers. And lesbians, bisexual, and gay youth are also more likely to contract sexually transmitted infections and HIV. Rice says sex education that reflects LGBTQ identities and experiences can go a long way toward turning those statistics around. He says inclusive sex ed can also support emotional development, too.
When we are recognizing the lived experience of a diverse range of students, we have the opportunity to make them feel seen, make them feel heard. That builds their self-esteem. It builds their confidence. They feel less isolated.
But Rice says changing the curriculum is an uphill battle. Lily Ferguson, the 17-year-old student I talked to, says she thinks young people can contribute a lot to the effort.
I think students pushing for more comprehensive sex ed can be really helpful because if students want something enough, schools have to listen to us.
The ACLU of Illinois says they're working on draft legislation that would require schools that teach sex ed to be LGBTQ inclusive. But a lawyer from the organization says they're waiting for the right time to introduce it. And until lawmakers and school districts make some changes, Lily Ferguson says kids like her will continue to be cheated out of a fair sex education. For Here and Now, I'm Lee Gaines.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
White House economic advisor Kevin Hassett told NBC News today that Fed Chairman Jerome Powell's job is safe. Fears that the president would fire Powell over his decision to keep raising interest rates helped spark a Christmas Eve sell-off on Wall Street. All of the major indexes are either at or near bear market territory. That means a 20% drop from an all-time high. The Dow did open higher today. For more, let's go to Uri Berliner, senior business editor at NPR. And Uri, let's start with Fed Chairman Jerome Powell. The White House now trying to make it clear he is not going anywhere. What do we know?
Economic advisor Kevin Hassett said Powell's job is 100% safe. This follows other administration officials, including Steven Mnuchin, saying that the president understands he doesn't have the authority to fire Powell. But the one person who's been silent about Powell's job status is the president, Donald Trump. Hmm.
Clearly, the administration is trying to manage this situation as the markets swoon. The president has gone as far as encouraging people to buy the dip. On Tuesday, he said this to reporters at the White House.
We have companies the greatest in the world, and they're doing really well. They have record kinds of numbers. So I think it's a tremendous opportunity to buy, really a great opportunity to buy.
Is it normal for a president to talk like this about markets when they're falling?
It is not normal at all. Presidents usually stay out of the way of the movements of markets. If markets fall, they normally wait for them to rebound. The same thing if markets are going higher, they don't normally take credit for them because they understand that they could fall again and get blamed for them. So it's highly unusual.
As we said, all of the U.S. indexes are either at or near bear markets. Just take a look around the globe, though. Italy, Japan, China, other countries that also have markets that are in bear territory. What's the financial picture around the world as we enter 2019?
Well, globally, the global economy seems to be slowing somewhat. China's growth is slowing. It's been going at a very rapid rate for years, as you know, but it has slowed somewhat. The U.S. has kind of been leading the global economy. 2018 was a very strong year for the economy in the U.S., but if the U.S. economy shows signs that it is starting to slow that growth, the rest of the world economy will be affected. So there are concerns in Europe, there are concerns in China about the pace of global recovery.
Does that mean that we should expect a fair amount of volatility for a while now? I mean, what's it going to take for the markets to get back on track?
Well, I mean, markets become volatile. I think there was a sense of unreality about the markets over the past several years. They were quite calm and just went up steadily. But for markets to be volatile, for markets to fall 10% or more, it's really not unusual. I mean, this decline has been sharp in recent months, but it's not really an extraordinary event if you look at the history of the markets. And what will it take to stop? Well, somebody's going to have to say, some brave soul is going to say, oh, prices are getting pretty cheap. I'm going to start buying and others will have to follow.
All right. Uri Berliner, senior business editor at NPR. Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Fifty years ago this week, humans went to the moon for the first time. Apollo 8 broke low Earth orbit, went to the moon, and orbited it 10 times. Astronauts Frank Borman, James Lovell, and William Anders were the first to see the moon's far side. Now, there's a new NOVA documentary about Apollo 8. It's called Apollo's Daring Mission. It airs tonight on PBS stations around the country. And joining us to talk about it are the film's director, Rushmore DeNoyer. Welcome to you.
Hi, welcome. Thanks.
And John Aaron is also with us. He was in Mission Control during Apollo 8. Welcome to you, John Aaron, as well.
Well, thank you.
And I want to start with you, Rushmore. What drew you to this topic, this film? This is a mission that probably if you asked most Americans if they could name most of the missions that NASA has done, this would not be one that comes to mind, but it was a very important mission. What drew you to this?
Precisely what you just said. I think it's one of the most important ever flown, and almost everybody knows about the first moon landing, Neil Armstrong. I would argue that the landing couldn't have happened if 8 hadn't happened.
Why did it end up going to the moon? It wasn't supposed to do that in the first place, John.
It wound up going to the moon because the original plan was that the command and service module, which went to the moon, was planned to do operations in Earth orbit with a lunar lander vehicle. Now, the lunar lander vehicle got behind in schedule and its development, and so the logical conclusion was, well, we've got enough objectives with the big Saturn V booster and the new redesigned command module that we could go to the moon and learn how to operate in the vicinity of the moon.
Obviously, the Cold War was a big part of that. The Russians were going to do it first, and the U.S. wanted to beat them.
Absolutely. That was America's and Kennedy's objective of going to the moon in the first place.
At the time, the troops on the front line in Mission Control weren't really aware of this, but the CIA told NASA, the Soviets are planning to send a man around the moon, not orbit, but go out to the moon, swing around, and return to Earth before the end of 1968, which essentially would have trumped us and beaten NASA and possibly ended the space race.
The film starts with a grim moment in NASA history, the launch pad death of three astronauts in the Apollo 1 space module. John, were you in Mission Control for that one?
That was my first shift on the Apollo program, having just come off the Gemini program.
Wow.
Yes, I was there in Mission Control the night that happened.
And what was that like? Would you remember about that?
Well, I was sitting there making sure that all of the communication circuits and the data circuits were working well. when suddenly I heard the event happen. And like I say, I was new to the program, but I knew what had happened instantly.
Mm-hmm. And then what did you have to do?
What my job was to capture all the data I could find, archive it, and put it together, and unfortunately go home and try to get some sleep.
Mm-hmm. Now, Rushmore, you started the film with that. Why did you decide to do that? What is the connection between that and the Apollo 8 mission?
Well, it really seemed to be a good bookend to the story. The Apollo 1 fire, you know, until the Challenger accident, that was the lowest moment I think NASA ever had. They lost three astronauts, and people knew what they were doing was very dangerous, but no one was thinking it was dangerous on the ground. I mean, this was considered a routine test. It wasn't even classified as dangerous. So, for example, they didn't have ambulances and fire trucks standing by because it was considered a routine test. That's, you know, I have to say, NASA investigated itself after the fire, and they didn't pull any punches, and they found a lot of problems with their procedures and a lot of problems with the spacecraft.
John, was that Apollo 1 disaster on your mind on the day of Apollo 8?
Well, yes, as well as other things. I think there was a contribution, unfortunately, that was made by those three astronauts relative to the space program. And I know that's something that you have to be careful how I think about that. But there are a number of things, weaknesses that had crept into the design of the spacecraft in addition to things that caused the fire. NASA stood down. They had a mindset that we're going to dissect this spacecraft from top to bottom. We're going to audit all the designs. And that's what happened. And after that fire, we put our heads down and did all that. And 22 months later, we had a brand new redesigned spacecraft that we flew on Apollo 7, and the spacecraft performed flawlessly.
One of the lasting legacies of Apollo 8 is that it is the first time that we got images of the Earth from the moon, right, Rush?
That's correct. A beautiful, beautiful photograph that Bill Anders took, and all three of the astronauts say that, you know, there was that moment. No one was expecting that they would be looking at the Earth or thinking about the Earth. First time anyone was close to the moon, they were scouting out good places to land. Nobody thought, oh, yeah, you ought to photograph the Earth as well. But when all three of them saw it, the way they tell it, they all started grabbing cameras and because it just took their breath away.
Yes, I remember that. You know, in retrospect, I think we went to the moon thinking we were going to spend that time studying about the moon. It got set up that way because the way the spacecraft attitudes on the way to the moon, the crew never got a chance to look back at the Earth. We went into lunar orbit, and it was two or three revolutions later before the attitude was changed. And when they came around the corner of the moon after being on the backside, wow, there it was.
Well, because there's no window out the back, right? It's just a rocket. So,
that's right.
So you can only look forward when you're in that.
So they were absolutely surprised, and they wound up what happened was probably captured the photograph that was the photograph of the last century. Hmm. That contribution, I believe, caused everybody on the planet to look different at our beautiful blue planet. How small it is, how fragile it looks. And that picture with our planet, our Earth, cast on a background of total darkness of space and the universe, gives you a whole new feeling of how to look at some of our problems here on Earth.
So that's a hell of a contribution, Rush. Is there any other big thing that we should know that you learned as you were putting this film together about Apollo 8, that a lasting legacy?
There's so much that Apollo accomplished. The Saturn V... You know, when John Glenn went into orbit for the first time, the first American to go into orbit, the rocket he was launched on had been tested without a person on it about 50 times. The Apollo 8 was only the third time that rocket ever flew, and here they were putting three people on it. The onboard computer that they developed for the Apollo spacecraft was an incredible accomplishment. It influenced our personal computers today. It was really the first time people trusted their lives to computers in the way that we now sort of take for granted.
Even though it looked like an old school calculator in the film, it doesn't look very modern today.
But I think the lasting legacy, you know, 1968 was an extremely divisive time in America. You know, we were bogged down in Vietnam. We had two major assassinations, one a presidential candidate, Bobby Kennedy, the other Martin Luther King. The Democratic National Convention in the summer broke down in riots, and no one expected it, but there they were. The last week of the year, we find this mission at the moon for the first time, circling the moon on Christmas Eve, and then the three astronauts read the story of Genesis from the Bible. Hmm. And it was an unbelievable moment.
In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light.
And remarkably, no one told them that they ought to do that. It was their own decision, which Frank Borman in the film makes the point. You know, you can't even imagine that happening today. There would be layers of bureaucracy and memos and whatnot. But they chose it themselves, mm-hmm. and it's an incredible moment.
The film is called Apollo's Daring Mission. It's a NOVA documentary about Apollo 8's trip to the moon. It's going to air tonight on PBS stations around the country. We've been speaking with John Aaron, who was in mission control for that mission, and also the director of the documentary. That would be Rushmore Denoyer. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Jeremy.
Thanks for having us. I appreciate it.
...2018 has been a year of ongoing scandal for the Catholic Church, with reports implicating hundreds of priests in sexual abuse cases. The problem includes the schools that train priests. Allison Sherry of Colorado Public Radio reports on one former seminarian who, two decades after being abused, is still waiting for closure.
Stephen Zuttenbach had a sheltered and conservative upbringing. His parents were Catholics, and the family's social life revolved around the church.
We had priests in our house fairly regularly growing up.
Zuttenbach was on the swim team and a valedictorian in high school. He aspired to become a priest and says he hadn't even kissed anyone when, right after he graduated in 2000, a priest who was his mentor came on to him sexually.
We'd be sitting on the couch eating lunch and he put his arm around me and then he would start to put his hand on my leg and start to try to cuddle with me and made me uncomfortable.
The priest was Kent Drotar. He went to Zuttenbach's swim meets and even bought him a laptop. That summer, he took Zuttenbach on a fishing trip and got a hotel room for the two of them. Zuttenbach said although they had two beds, he woke up to the priest fondling him.
I just remember feeling like just incredibly icky through the whole thing. And he offered to hear my confession, which is against canon law, because you can't absolve someone for a sin to which you are party to.
Zuttenbach studied to become a priest at St. John Vianney Theological Seminary in Denver when he was just 19. Father Drotar greatly controlled his academic and religious future at the seminary. And Zuttenbach says the priest continued his unwelcome behavior. Drotar did not respond to multiple requests to comment for this story. Zuttenbach says he felt beholden to Father Drotar and didn't tell anyone what was going on.
And I didn't want to hurt him either, because if I said something about it, I would hurt him. So, you know, it was kind of this mutually assured destruction.
Zuttenbach ended up leaving the seminary and applied to architecture school in Florida. He wanted to get away and live openly as a gay man. When he came out to Drotar, the priest told him that God didn't make gay people. In 2007, 3 years after he cut ties with the seminary and Drotar, Zuttenbach came back to Vianney to visit one of his favorite professors, Marika Frank. Frank told him about a student who was having a hard time getting ordained because Reverend Drotar thought he was too flamboyant. Zuttenbach blurted out that was ironic given what he'd been through. His professor stopped him.
He told me enough that I could tell this was a case of sexual abuse, and so I named it. I said, "Stephen, you realize you were sexually abused." And that didn't seem to have occurred to him. I mean, he hadn't framed it that way for himself.
Frank told her colleague Jeannie Engelbert, who was on the priest formation team and is a therapist. Engelbert sent detailed information about the situation to Archdiocese leadership.
I had complete faith that they would honor the young man and that they would do the right thing.
Then Archbishop Charles Chaput sent Drotar away to therapy for 7 weeks. Engelbert and Frank figured that would be it, and he wouldn't get any other assignments. But when Drotar returned, Chaput assigned him to a parish in Denver, a parish with a school. Engelbert was stunned, so she wrote to Chaput expressing her concern.
My thought was, wherever they sent him or whoever treated him obviously didn't get it. And so I need to let him know. I mean, I was speaking from my clinical understanding, my psychological training, my theological training. I'm like, he must not get it. And so I'm going to lay it out really clearly.
Numerous stories of priests abusing seminarians have come out in the past year. The U.S. Conference of Bishops has considered doing more on the issue, but so far hasn't really taken it up. Engelbert says she believes the church leadership is more interested in protecting itself.
I think why these things are occurring in seminaries is that it's a closed system. It needs to be opened up to provide a sense of accountability, safety, normalcy.
When Zettenbach heard that Chaput was keeping his abuser in a parish, he asked him for a face-to-face meeting. The archbishop met him at a coffee shop near the diocese.
And I told him in no uncertain terms, I said, either you guys do the right thing, or I'm going to go to the press.
Mark Haas is a spokesman for the archdiocese. He says Chaput learned new information in that meeting that led him to convene a conduct response team. And within a few weeks, Reverend Drotar was pulled from the parish. Haas notes that he is speaking on behalf of leadership that has changed, but that proper protocols were followed.
The information that was available to them at each step, they followed, and from what we can tell, I mean, the ultimate outcome was that this man was removed from the priesthood.
Haas says Drotar can no longer call himself a priest or work as one anywhere in the world. But the church stopped short of officially defrocking or laicizing Drotar. Stephen Zettenbach says he wants to be sure Drotar won't have his rights restored by some archbishop down the road. Zettenbach also says he's seen Drotar call himself a priest on social media as recently as last year.
You know, I really hope they do what they said they would do 10 years ago. There's no reason not to. I mean, really.
The archdiocese says defrocking a priest requires permission from Rome, and they're pursuing that, but spokesman Haas wouldn't say where they were in the process or why it hasn't happened before.
We're not trying to minimize at all the experience that this young man went through, but we do want to stress that from what we can tell, the archdiocese handled it exactly as it should have. He's not acting as a priest anymore. I mean, the process worked.
Zettenbach says he's lost his faith completely, not because of the abuse, but because of the way he was treated when he reported it. For Here and Now, I'm Allison Sherry.
Is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.